Another couple of wild cards in the markets. News of the arrest in Canada of the chief financial officer of China's huge Huawei telephone company. Her name is
Meng. We're seeing U.S. futures fall quite substantially. Is this all tied to this Huawei deal, do you think?
All right, Kristen, talking about what's going on in the markets as it relates to Huawei, a company that a lot of Americans may not have even heard about until just recently. But this is important as it relates to the bigger picture with Donald Trump and trade.
Cue the shots of Wall Street types standing on the trading floor with their heads in their hands. The stock market took another big nosedive today on news that Canadian officials arrested a top Chinese tech executive for extradition to the United States. That executive is named Meng Wanzhou. She's the chief financial officer of Huawei, which is basically like China's version of Apple, only bigger. She's also the daughter of Huawei's founder and is largely believed to be next in line to head the tech giant. She was arrested late last week, but news didn't break until yesterday. And at this point, it's not completely clear why the United States wants her extradited, though speculation is that this is linked to American sanctions on Iran. Joining us to talk about Meng's arrest and what it could mean for some very important upcoming trade talks with China is Clayton Duby, director of USC's U.S.-China Institute. Welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
Well, tell us more about this company, Huawei. Why is it such a big deal that the CEO and likely future leader of this company was arrested?
Well, first of all, Huawei is enormous. It's, in fact, in many ways, more important to the Chinese economy and more important in the tech sector in China than Apple is in the United States. Huawei is a combination of Cisco Systems, which provides all the networking equipment that powers our phone conversations and our internet links, as well as a handset maker, as well as a cell phone maker. And it is enormous. Its influence within China is gigantic, and it has an international reach. It's built networks all across Africa. It's building them elsewhere.
Okay, so a big deal, obviously, that its CFO and daughter of the leader of the company is now under arrest. Why do you think that happened?
Well, until she shows up in court, and presumably she'll contest the extradition, we won't know. And we won't know for sure. I think, though, that the speculation that this is somehow connected to Huawei perhaps violating U.S. sanctions in selling equipment to Iran could very well be the cause of her arrest.
Still, it does. People are questioning the timing of this, just as we are in these very tense trade talks and disputes with China.
That's correct. And once again, this indicates just how sprawling the U.S. government is. And it's likely that this was not a coordinated action. This was not discussed with the folks who are handling trade. Rather, this is the province of those who are charged with enforcing sanctions. And these folks might probably don't talk to each other and don't have the same priorities. And so in terms of this arrest, yes, it comes at a terrible time for U.S.-China relations and specifically for these trade talks, but it is something that might be expected. The United States had massive sanctions against Huawei's cousin company, ZTE, and in fact imposed what would have been a death sentence on the company, but for a reprieve issued by President Trump.
For doing business in Iran?
Iran and North Korea, yes.
Mm. Okay. Well, there had been some global souring on Huawei in recent years, right, with Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Britain scrutinizing this company. What were they looking at?
Well, the company, because of its founder, Ren Zhengfei is the founder, and he's now 74 years old, so probably his daughter was soon to move into the top position. She's been with the company for 25 years, so she has a lot of experience at Huawei and is positioned to be the next leader of it. But the company has its origins really lie in the Chinese military and then come out of that. And since ownership is somewhat murky, and because most tech companies have to have close connections and cooperation with the Chinese government, there have always been suspicions that if you install Huawei equipment, you might be installing a window for Beijing.
To spy.
To monitor what's going on. Now, that's not been proven. There have been no demonstrated cases of this, and a number of places use Huawei equipment all the time. And it's important to note that Google, which is, you know, kind of famously suspicious of the Chinese government and has this low-grade war going on with the Chinese government, it actually hired Huawei to produce its own phone. And in fact, according to Huawei, Huawei produced one series of phones but declined to produce the next because it would be in competition with Google on that. So nothing has been demonstrated. Nothing has been proven. And it's important to note that the NSA has been inside Huawei. In 2013, it was revealed that they had hacked Huawei's servers, the same kind of thing that the U.S. government says that Huawei would be capable of doing were we to all use Huawei phones or Huawei cell phone towers and that sort of thing.
Well, why don't we use Huawei phones here?
Because of the suspicion. It's flat out just because of the suspicion. In 2008, Huawei wanted to buy a major tech company, 3Com, and that was turned down by the U.S. government. And so that was kind of the first shot across the bow. In 2012, the House Intelligence Committee issued a report suggesting that no American government agency and no American company should be using either Huawei or ZTE equipment for this reason. So since 2012, it's been on essentially a blacklist, and there's been pressure on the major telecoms to not while you may use ZTE phones and you may use Huawei phones, but to not sponsor them, to not offer them as part of an enrollment package. And so, for example, AT&T and Verizon, they had talked about offering the latest Huawei flagship phone, but ultimately, because of this kind of suspicion and pressure, decided not to do so.
Okay, so back to this arrest. Do you think it's being used as a bargaining chip at all? Or are you saying that the one hand didn't know what the other hand is doing, but a bargaining chip for these upcoming tariff talks?
Well, I know that in China it will be suspected, many people in China will believe that that was the goal, is to go ahead and hold this company hostage, as it were, and to, you know, to use that as a chip. I doubt that that was the decision that was made, but rather it was, again, one of these things where you have a very big government and not all sides know what the others are up to.
Well, what do you think, though, could be the long-term effects of this in terms of our relationship with China?
Well, this definitely is going to leave a bad taste in the mouth of especially the economic nationalists in China. They say, see, America really doesn't want competition, and it will stop at nothing to block competition. America is committed to not letting us rise economically, to not letting us become a tech competitor on an even field. And so people who are of that mindset are going to use this, even though I don't believe that, in fact, is American policy, and I don't believe that that is, in fact, even possible. I don't think it's within the power of any foreign country to keep China down. China will continue to rise economically, and its tech proficiency will continue to advance as well.
Clayton Dubey, director of USC's U.S.-China Institute, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, since Meng Wanzhou's arrest, fears of a trade war with China have increased and the Dow has dropped a lot. We're also hearing that many economists now expect a downturn in the coming year, including experts at J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, UCLA's Anderson School of Management. Chris Thornburg is here now. He's founding partner at Beacon Economics. Hello.
Hi.
Okay, so are you one of the doomsayers?
No. Let's talk about trade, for example, with China. Is the trade situation with China liable to create some sort of massive problem for the U.S. economy? I would say no. The issues with China, I think it's real. China does need to play a little fairer in the global trade sandbox. But in the short run, you know, let's look at what the dynamics of what's happening. The main problem with China is not exporting stuff to China. We don't export much to them. It's not that big of a deal. The big risk, of course, is on the import side. 20% of all manufactured imports come from China. And if those have a 25% tariff slapped on them, that's going to make stuff moving through the U.S. supply chain that much more expensive. But, you know, as a response, to, of course, the threat of tariffs, the Chinese yuan has dropped by about 14% over the course of the last 6 months. A cheaper yuan will pay for about 60% plus of that tariff. And for the stock market itself, the fact that the stock market is dumping is should be something that nobody should pay any attention to. The stock market is not about the economy. The volatility of the stock market is about the stock market. Take a step back even further. Corporate profits are starting to grow again inside the United States. The U.S. economy is really rocking and rolling right now. Labor markets are tight. Wages are up. Corporate profits are up. There's nothing fundamentally wrong with where the U.S. is right now. There's no reason to suddenly assume that, we're going to not be able to weather this little bit of a storm with the Chinese trade.
What about big companies, though, like chip manufacturers and companies like Apple that have exposure, big exposure to China? There is some talk of a possible boycott of Apple, for example, in China to retaliate for the arrest of Meng Wanzhou. What about that? I mean, Apple is an industry leader.
That is true. But you've got to remember, the actual cost of manufacturing that iPhone is a tiny part of, what you pay when you go out and you spend that $1,000 on that brand new iPhone X, SE, or whatever they're selling nowadays. They can handle a little bit of a higher price. Will they take a little bit of a profit hit? Sure. But on the other hand, Apple is hardly, shall we say, short of profits or retained earnings. They'll be able to weather this storm just fine, thank you very much. For me, the much larger risk for Apple is, when are you going to do something new? Mm-hmm. They've always been a product leader. When's the last time they came out with a new product of any, you know, anything noteworthy? And the answer is, not in a long time. As for, you know, whether China decides to boycott Apple products or not, that's really more up to Chinese citizens than it is up to, shall we say, the Chinese government. And I tell you right now, they like their iPhones.
So you don't see any warning signs headed into 2019 of a possible recession?
Absolutely not. If you look at the fundamentals of the U.S. economy, from household finances to rising wages to the amount of debt inside the U.S. economy outside of public debt, things look good. The reason the U.S. economy is healthy is because that is the default mode of the U.S. economy. Growth is normal. The abnormal parts of the economy are, those periods of time, what we call recessions, and those are caused by some sort of large shock to the system, a massive housing collapse and a big pullback in consumer spending, such as the Great Recession. But these are always on the back end of some big imbalance building inside the economy. This has been a relatively moderate growth expansion. Not too hot, not too cold. No major imbalances have popped up. For years, we were complaining, why isn't the economy growing a little bit faster? Well, actually, the fact that it's been slow and steady is exactly why it's still healthy 10 years on. And while this expansion could, candidly, if we have good government policy, go on for another 5-6 years, no problem.
So when you look at the housing markets in the most expensive cities like Los Angeles, and you see these insane prices and few people able to afford to buy a house these days, that's not a giant warning sign to you?
It is a giant warning sign that California needs to build more housings. Prices are what they are is because that's what the marginal buyer can afford. I know that sounds weird because we like to think of, well, housing isn't affordable. Most people can't buy these homes. Well, somebody can, and because they are. That's why the prices are what they are.
Mm-hmm.
It's the person who wants to buy that house. It's their income that matters. And right now, the people who are moving to L.A. are very high-income folks who can afford these prices. It's the barrier to entry. The cure for this is more housing.
Where do you foresee this dispute with China headed?
Trump's just looking for a quick win. My feeling is the Chinese are trying to figure out what kind of bone they can throw him to give him that quick win. And this thing will fade away. It's just like NAFTA, right? NAFTA is the worst thing ever. We have a brand new agreement, which is 98.78%, exactly the same as the old NAFTA, but it's a big success for the administration. That should be a lesson to anyone dealing with the Trump administration. They're not looking for real results. They're looking for the ability to proclaim victory. Chinese just have to figure out how to throw them that bone. This thing goes away.
All right, Chris, thank you so much.
Sorry to be so optimistic today, Madeline.
I know, it's bumming me out on a rainy day.
Indeed.
Chris Thornburg, founding partner at Beacon Economics. Well, Chris talked about housing. We're going to talk about a new push to build more housing near transit here in California. That story coming up next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. One big idea for fixing California's housing problems is to build, well, more homes near public transportation, a lot more homes. State officials say we're about 3.5 million houses short of what we need. And that lack of supply, and of course the high demand, is what's driving up housing prices in cities like ours in Los Angeles. So building up around public transportation could kill two birds with one stone. More housing to help the shortage and less traffic and pollution. But earlier this year, when a state senator proposed a law that would have forced cities to do just that, that bill died, and it died fast. Well, now, less than a year later, that bill is back. KCRW reporter Anna Scott is here to tell us about it. Hi.
Hi.
Okay, would it do exactly the same thing?
Not exactly the same thing. So as you said, this is a reboot of a bill that died in April. It was proposed by State Senator Scott Wiener of San Francisco. The first bill, SB 827, died before it got very far. So this is a tweaked version of it, SB 50, or as I like to call it, 8272, Electric Boogaloo. That is a reference to an 80s breakdancing movie.
Excellent.
You got to give the people a spoonful of sugar. It does change some things about the original bill, but the gist of it is it would force cities to build more housing near big bus and rail lines. Scott Wiener says we really need the housing, but
what we don't want to do is do what we've always done in California, which is just to build further and further out and have a lot of sprawl, cover up farmland, open space, build in wildfire zones. We want to focus that housing around public transportation and job centers.
Okay, well, that sounds reasonable, especially given the devastating fires we've just gone through.
Mm-hmm.
How would the bill accomplish this?
The big thing it would do is prevent cities from blocking apartment projects that are within a half mile of a rail line or a quarter mile of a major bus station. It does some other things as well, like removing minimum parking requirements on apartment projects in those zones. So, you know, most apartment buildings in cities like LA have to build a certain amount of parking, and that can be really expensive. So the idea is, hey, if these are near public transportation anyway, you'll encourage people to take that transit, and then also you can build things faster. And it also encourages the development of mid-rise apartment buildings. So the idea is to get a lot of 4-5-story buildings, kind of infill projects around public transportation.
All right, so that all sounds, as I said earlier, pretty reasonable. What's the problem?
Well, this was very controversial the first time around for a lot of reasons. One is that it's actually a big deal to take these kinds of land use decisions out of the hands of local government. So a lot of mayors, city councils did not like it, including our own mayor, Eric Garcetti. Homeowner groups didn't like it. Here in LA, we saw pushback. And also it got pushback from tenant advocates and renters' rights groups who said it didn't have enough protections for people already renting apartments in these areas near public transit, that there's no guarantee that they wouldn't be cleared out for new buildings. And finally, labor unions didn't like it, and they have a lot of political influence in the Capitol. So now there's more certainty for construction workers' unions, and they have gotten on board.
And what else has changed in this new version?
Well, there are more tenant protections for people renting apartments already near public transportation. There's also one provision in there specifically tailored to LA that says if a community is already doing this stuff, encouraging new dense development near public transportation, then they would be exempt in those zones. LA is doing that in a number of neighborhoods. So we do have some flexibility and some local control that would be retained.
Okay, so any idea what, if this bill passes and becomes a statewide law, what this would mean for Los Angeles?
Well, I'm still figuring that out. And there are parts of the bill that are still a work in progress. But one thing that Scott Wiener made clear when I spoke to him this morning is that this isn't about building high rises all over the city. This is really about looking for opportunities to build smaller apartment projects near public transportation.
It's not about putting gigantic, super tall buildings. It's about putting in what we call the missing middle. Instead of just having big high rises in a few neighborhoods and only single family homes everywhere else, let's build small to mid-sized apartment buildings.
And do we know where our politicians line up on this new version of this bill?
Well, Mayor Eric Garcetti, who was not a fan of the first version, is supporting this version of it. And we'll see where our new governor, Gavin Newsom, stands on this. The first time around, he was lukewarm on that version of it. He definitely supports new housing construction and says we need a lot more to address our shortage. But we'll see if this new version of this bill is what he wants.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's KCRW's Anna Scott. Coming up, after being crowned as having the best burger in America, a small restaurant in Portland, Oregon shut down, how best of lists can have negative repercussions.
Often restaurants or bars or, you know, hot dog carts are not asked if they're okay with being placed at the top of these lists.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, a few weeks ago, a viral essay started popping up, well, everywhere on the internet, as viral things do. It was titled, "I Found the Best Burger Place in America, and Then I Killed It." The essay was written by Kevin Alexander for Thrillist, and its buzzy title pretty much sums up the story. After trying hundreds of burgers across the country, he ranked a family sports bar in Portland called Stanix the best burger in America. Not even a year later, though, Stanix closed down, ostensibly because the management couldn't handle the restaurant's newfound popularity. But the actual story turned out to be much more complicated than that. Helen Rossner writes about food for The New Yorker, and she wrote about Stanix and the ethical responsibilities of being a food critic. And Helen joins me now. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. Happy to be here.
Great to have you. Well, so his story was initially received as really kind of a condemnation of listicle culture, sort of live by the listicle, die by the listicle. Why did that resonate so much in the restaurant world?
Well, you know, the point that Alexander was making with his second piece, it all starts getting very complicated here. There are so many stories about stories, is a really important one. Basically, what Kevin Alexander was saying was that the way that we live now, a sort of combination of internet culture and Instagram-driven travel, and also just sort of the interest in food as an engine of tourism and travel and cultural experience, means that increasingly all of us in America, pretty much anybody with internet access, is relying on lists to help us understand what we should be doing, how we should be spending our time, how we should be spending our money. And in the case of something like Stanix, which is effectively a neighborhood sports bar, right? Like, it's a local tavern where little league teams and local families would just sort of drop by. It had been part of the neighborhood for 60, 70 years, is not really equipped to be a tourist destination in the way that a position at the top of this kind of list can catapult a place into being a tourist destination. And it raises all sorts of interesting questions that maybe journalists and editors hadn't considered, but also that maybe average diners and eaters hadn't considered about, you know, how much did this restaurant's move into the spotlight change the fundamental nature of what had made it great in the first place?
Right. And it's a different kind of thing when it's a neighborhood sports bar versus like a Dominique Ansel, you know, multi-million dollar restaurant with a cronut at the center of it. You know,
it's like... Precisely. I mean, those places are engineered to deal with volume. They're engineered for crowds, which also I think ties into the other really important point that he was making in this essay, though it was a bit more subtle, which is that often restaurants or bars or, you know, hot dog carts, are not asked if they're okay with being placed at the top of these lists. You know, an editor doesn't necessarily reach out and say, hey, listen, like, we're going to put you at the top of a list of the best burgers in the country, and what might happen could be really upsetting for you, or brace for the storm, or whatever it might be. You know, you reach out and you say, hey, you're on the top of our list. Congratulations. Here's a plaque. But there's not so much engagement with the potential pitfalls of an unasked for thrusting into the spotlight of a place that isn't necessarily seeking it.
You know, it's interesting because we are in LA and the list of 101 restaurants, best restaurants from the LA Times has just come out. It's the first one since Jonathan Gold's passing, and he was the arbiter, the creator of this list. And he is sort of the godfather of this kind of elevate the common eatery into a destination restaurant type of critic. And we've all associated that with an unalloyed good, that he is shining a spotlight on restaurants and restaurateurs who are working really, really hard and just trying to make it. And it's difficult to make it in the restaurant world. And this would be great if they got some more business. But sure. You're saying that there's this other side to it that we haven't really considered.
Well, you know, I think Jonathan Gold is a terrific example. He was an incredibly considerate critic and a considerate elevator and endorser of the restaurants that he wrote about. You know, I know that he would often avoid writing about certain places, say, like if there was a particular taco stand that was wonderful, but the person running it was undocumented, he might avoid putting out their location. He was very thoughtful about the ways in which the livelihood and security of the people running the restaurant and the restaurants as a business would weigh against the literally ravenous interests of the people who wanted to come and eat the food that they produced.
Okay, so let's talk about this particular restaurant, Stanix, which closed down. It didn't necessarily close down, apparently, because of this review or this elevation as having the best burger in America. They were having other problems.
Yeah, here's where the story gets kind of twisty. So in his essay examining why Stanix had closed, Kevin Alexander spoke with the proprietor of the restaurant, Steve Stanick, who was the second generation proprietor. His parents had started the restaurant in the 1940s, I think. And he basically said, yeah, you know, like we were overwhelmed with clientele. The quality of food and the quality of service and the kind of experience that I was giving people wasn't what I wanted. So we had to close. And then he also hinted at some additional problems. And here in his story, Kevin Alexander said that Stanick requested to go off the record to talk about his personal problems. And he alluded in the essay to these personal problems by saying, it's the sort of thing that could happen in any family. About a week or two after this original essay was published, a reporter at Willamette Week, which is also up in Oregon, did some digging into the history of Steve Stanick and found out that in 2014, he had been arrested on a domestic violence charge that was pretty abhorrent. He had been arrested for choking his wife, who also at the time had stage 4 cancer. The course of the next 4 years and then an additional 2 years, he violated his probation a number of times. He was jailed briefly for being in contempt of court. He and his wife went through a very contentious divorce. And for the reporter at Willamette Week to pull up this example and for this to be held against that one throwaway line, you know, the sort of thing that could happen in any family, was something that was really galling for a lot of people.
But did Kevin Alexander know, or did he just leave it at that and not pursue the story, that side of the story?
When I reached out to Kevin while I was sort of trying to untie all of the knots of this very tangled story, what he wound up telling me through a Thrillist representative was that when he initially started researching Stanix and Steve Stanick, he came across, I would imagine, basically just a Google result or something like that, indicating that Stanick had had this 2014 arrest and conviction for domestic violence. But he thought to himself, hey, I'm writing a story about burgers. This isn't a story about this stuff, which is messy and distressing and dark. So he chose not to pursue it. And Alexander says that the things that Stanick told him during that off-the-record moment in their conversation that he alludes to in their essay were not specifically about his violent history. They were about other family things that I think were probably more in line with what we all imagined he was talking about. But The question to me is not what's the real reason that this restaurant closed. The question became a very different one, which is what's the responsibility of someone who thinks he's writing a burger story when he comes across something that indicates that the people he's writing about might have skeletons in their closet, might have an unsavory aspect to their personality, to their history, and to their identity that maybe is not directly related to the narrative that you want to tell about restaurant ownership and burger quality, but is nonetheless part of the holistic story of who they are as an individual and the family that they are part of.
Wow. So I guess that is a big question for these kind of writers. Like, do you then go into a whole investigative mode and find out everything you need to know before you write a food review or just review the food?
Yeah. I mean, restaurant critics have been struggling with this forever, really, but it's been a question that's risen to the fore, certainly since the Me Too movement kind of recapitulated into the spotlight a little bit over a year ago. I think that the answer is pretty clear cut. I think that there's really no such thing as food on a plate without context. I think that, as I mentioned in my story, restaurants are holistic, complex organisms, and it's not really possible to talk about food without talking about the people who exist within the economy of the food.
Hmm. Well, I guess that's like, you know, when you read The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot, do you keep in mind that he was anti-Semitic? I don't know. That's been,
yeah.
That's been a conversation when it comes to art for a long time. Do you look at Pablo Picasso and how he treated women, or do you just look at the paintings?
Right. And, you know, I think that, like, everybody knows what it feels like to just close your mouth and taste the food, right? Like, you can look at the image of a Picasso painting and respond to it on a purely aesthetic level. But if you really do want to engage with it, if you want to have a critical relationship with it, it is important to understand the work, whatever it is, whether it's a Woody Allen movie or a Mahler symphony, within the context of the artist that created it, what their inspirations were, what their rejections were, what they were responding to, what they were in dialogue with. And all of that is what exists within the pantheon of criticism, which is ultimately what a 100 top burgers list is, even though it's been flattened into a listicle. It's an act of criticism, and I think it requires the same level of responsibility.
I guess I'm wondering, so what do you do as a critic, as a food writer, when you come upon, let's say, Mario Batali? Like, are you not going to review his restaurants now, or do you always put in the article, if you do review the restaurants, oh, his sex harassment, the allegations against him of sexual harassment. How do you handle that?
It's a good question. I mean, if I had an easy answer for that, I think that, I don't know, I would be some kind of billionaire. But, you know, restaurant critics all over the country have been struggling with this. There are restaurateurs in Texas who are struggling with how to cover Paul Key. There are critics in LA who weren't sure how to cover The Horse and Hound, April Bloomfield's restaurant, after the news broke about a year ago that her partner, Ken Friedman, had just been a serial sexual predator at their restaurants in New York. Jonathan Gold, to go back to Jonathan Gold, covered Hearth and Hound by mentioning that Bloomfield was part of the sort of orbit of this sexual abuse scandal. And he said sort of explicitly in his review of the restaurant, like, I've now told you the information. I leave it to you to decide. And here's what I thought was really good at the restaurant that you should order if you decide to go. Other critics, like the reviews that run on the website eater.com, they declared that they're no longer going to be reviewing the restaurants of people who they consider quote unquote bad actors. And that comes from a place of thinking that if it's a positive review, even if it has an asterisk, even if it has a bolded note at the top, is effectively an endorsement of that restaurant.
Well, I guess there is also, Helen, the issue of redemption and whether or not these restaurants and these restaurateurs and these chefs and what have you, if they have done bad things, whether they can, you know, earn back your good graces and be reviewed favorably without or mention of any past misdeeds when it comes to how they treated their staff or other people.
Yeah. You know, it's questions like those that make me happy that I'm no longer a restaurant critic. I know maybe this is a weird thing to say, but like, I'm not happy that there are so many bad men in the spotlight right now. Like, I'm glad that our industry as a whole and that our society as a whole is finally paying attention to problems that have existed and that we have all kind of known existed for generations. But the process of dealing with it, the process of correcting our behavior and our priorities, is difficult and messy and not fun. So, you know, I don't know. I don't think that, like, you know, if Mario Batali showed up tomorrow and said, hey, I'm like donating my entire net worth to some nonprofit that helps the victims of sexual assault, and I'm dedicating myself entirely to making sure that my restaurants are the best possible places for women and queer people and people of color to work, bar none in the entire world. Like, sure, I would receive that with happiness, but I would also kind of want to see where that stands in 5 years.
Hmm. Helen, thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's Helen Rossner. She's a food correspondent for The New Yorker. And joining us now is Warren Olney, host of To The Point, the podcast. Hi.
Hi.
So what's on your show this week?
We're going to have a balanced look at George H.W. Bush, and that would include the Willie Horton ad and what one reporter calls the dirtiest political campaign he ever covered in 1988, the campaign against Michael Dukakis that put Bush in the White House. We'll also talk about his diplomatic successes, his restraint in the war on Iraq, and he is remembered as one of the first real environmental presidents because
really?
Of his sense of the importance of industrial pollution blowing across international borders. He actually instituted cap and trade as a way to help Canada.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I had no idea. I've learned something.
There you are. That's why it's worth listening to this podcast.
I know. Learn a lot more. Tune in.
You got
to The Point, the podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you, Warren.
Okay.
Coming up, taking personal health monitoring to the next level in Silicon Valley. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Here's a gift idea for that person on your list who has everything already. A personal pollution monitor. Yeah. That tells you how good or how bad the air quality around you is. Nellie Bowles of The New York Times calls it the hottest apocalypse gadget for 2019. She's here now. Hi there.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So this is the thing in Silicon Valley. Everyone's got one of these things?
Well, not everyone yet, but it's definitely something that you're starting to see pop up in homes. Concern over air quality and distrust of the government air quality monitoring is growing, both in Silicon Valley and really around the country.
Right.
And so you're seeing folks start to buy these personal pollution monitors, these little gadgets. There's a whole lot of them. You've got some that are meant to sit inside your house, some that you're meant to hook onto your backpack and wear around with you while you're going through the world, some that you plug in outside and that loop into a sort of network, a global network. And basically it's to tell how good the air is right around you.
Yeah, and some of them have really catchy names. One's AWARE, spelled A-W-A-I-R. Mm-hmm. A little play on words there. So what happens when you are aware of the air and you realize how bad it is? Then what?
That's the question. So in the case of, let's say, like the main one that the government's actually interested in potentially using also is this one, Purple Air. For about $200 or $300, you plug it in outside and you can get a pretty good sense of how good the air is day by day, and you can get your neighborhood to use them too. And then what you can do is, let's say you're trying to prove that a nearby factory makes your air quality bad on windy days, this can be used as evidence. You can use it to pressure your government to take actions against that factory or whatever. But basically, because most government sensors are these $100,000 to several $100,000 facilities, there's usually like one in a region. And so you're not getting microclimates, you're not getting a neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is like a way to gather your neighborhood and push back. Or let's say you're just someone who wants to hook it onto your back while you're biking around the city. You can use it to decide this route's a better route, this route is a worse route based on how the air is along that route.
And it's accurate?
Well, That's a little bit in question. The best thing that they are definitely accurate, or most of them are accurate at, it's showing variance, like showing change. Mm-hmm. And so if one day is worse than another day, you can definitely see that. Purple air and some of the sort of more expensive ones are, the government's testing them now. The EPA has a program to test out how good these air quality, these personal air quality tools are. And so the sort of verdict is still out on whether or not they're going to be deemed accurate.
And then, of course, it all depends on the amount of particulates and how your body would react to them, right, in to prove whether or not they'd be actually unhealthy for you.
Yeah. I mean, in general, cleaner air is
healthier. Yeah.
Better.
Right, right. But, I mean, there can be a certain amount of stuff in the air that's not necessarily
going to
give you
cancer.
Totally.
And anywhere in the world, there's going to be a certain amount of stuff in the air. You're not going to get, like, some perfect pure air situation.
Right. And you're not necessarily going to get sick from the dirty air.
No, for sure. But there's worries right now that some of the government sensors are being put in places that have cleaner air. You know, they're put in a very residential neighborhood where when most people live, you know, near a freeway or whatever. Like, mm-hmm. And so even though, okay, the EPA is saying that the air is at this level of particulate matter that day, maybe in your neighborhood it's actually worse, and people are concerned that it's intentionally not being picked up. So that's kind of anxiety that's driving this.
But it seems, yeah.
And then obviously, like, the Trump EPA had said a whole lot about wanting to pull back on some regulations around air quality. One of the new science advisors said that the air is a little bit too clean for optimal health, which other people have pushed back on.
Yeah.
So there's the concern is coming from really a message that the government is sending, which is that some of the air quality measures that have been taken in the last decade have gone too far, is basically their line.
Okay, but these things are expensive, right? So I imagine that it's people of a certain, like, they're a couple hundred dollars. So it's people of a certain mm-hmm. means who can afford to buy these things. And they probably don't live in the poorest neighborhoods where the air in general is worse.
Yeah. I mean, but those neighborhoods are also not being monitored by, are often neglected by the existing sensors.
So actually,
lot of these little sensors are being used by what are called sort of citizen data scientists. I don't know. The movement's called, a lot of them are calling themselves breathers, which is basically this idea that, like, you know, we all are breathing. So breathers are interested in a sort of activism around this. And there's a couple groups now that are crowdfunding to get air quality sensors into poor neighborhoods so that they can, like, I went to one in Pittsburgh where it's a group and it's associated with Carnegie Mellon is putting a bunch of air quality sensors around a neighborhood in Pittsburgh that's near a factory, and they're trying to use it to say this factory is polluting more than is legally allowed. And that hasn't been picked up, and they want to pick it up and say, we can't ignore this.
So there is some activism to it. It's not just about wearing a
Fitbit
for your lungs.
Yeah, it's not just like crazy
lungs.
Rich people.
Yeah.
But
okay.
Of course, like, crazy rich people and, like, you know, health nuts like me in San Francisco are going to, like, take it to the most extreme. So I've got air filters, you know. The nuts here in San Francisco will, of course, take it to the logical, nutty conclusion.
You have your own air sensor?
I air filter now. I started after the fires. You know, I got really nervous. And so that's why I started thinking about all this stuff. Because the air was bad. And I was, like, reading about air and reading about how it's measured. And I don't know, kind of wanted to take it into my own hands.
And so now you have a filter and your air is cleaner?
I mean, I think so. I don't know. I have a filter. It tells me that the air is cleaner because the purple light turns blue, and that seems to be clean. But yeah, that's how I come up with these wacky trend stories. It's literally like it usually comes from me being a guinea pig for it.
Tell us about the founder of Purple Air, this company
you've
been talking
about.
Yeah,
so Purple Air is really the main one that everyone's really interested in right now because it's building also a guerrilla network worldwide of air quality that you can go and look at. You can go online. And so during the California fires, people were looking at that instead of looking at the government website, for one, because the government website was crashing a lot, and then also it wasn't updating as fast. And so Purple Air, you plug it in outside. The guy who started it in his backyard in Salt Lake, in Salt Lake City. He was watching the dust blow from a nearby mine or nearby gravel pit, and the gravel pit folks wanted to expand it, and he was hoping to gather some evidence to show that they shouldn't expand it. They shouldn't come closer to his house. And so he found some laser sensors and kind of cobbled this thing together. And then it's taken off. So he started that a few years ago. And then now in the last year, interest has just spiked. And he's moved into a proper workspace. And it's gone from kind of a hobbyist electronics project to a real company.
Hmm. Well, it is really interesting that this is, as you write, this confluence of concerns in Silicon Valley and elsewhere that the government is not doing this stuff anymore, protecting public health, so citizens have to take it into their own hands. And at the same time, there is this obsession with personal data collection when it comes to your own health.
Of course. And Silicon Valley has a long history of kind of wanting body purity, wacky diets. I've written about raw water, which is like trying to get into untreated water. There's a real distrust of our national government here, mm-hmm. and there has been for a long time, like long before Trump. And all of this kind of fits into that. This idea of like, let's decentralize things, let's take it into our own hands. A kind of off-the-gridderness, which is funny because it's the people who are building the grid. but there's a desire to kind of be a self-sustaining, skeptical creature.
While on the grid.
Well on the grid, yeah.
It's one thing if you control the grid.
Building, yeah, exactly. Building the most sophisticated grid that's ever existed.
Nellie Bowles covers tech and internet culture in San Francisco for The New York Times. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Christian Bordahl.
Hey, Madeline Brand.
What do you have for us today?
Well, I found that so interesting, the stuff about the personal air quality monitors,
because
we're all kind of, particularly here in Los Angeles, we all think about that a lot.
I kind of don't want to know, because I kind of know already.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. Well, I, you know, when the campfire, we had those bad air quality days because of the campfire and all the smoke actually blew down here, so I went online and I Googled to see, like, you know, what's the air quality going on in Los Angeles right now? And I got on this Purple Air site that has a map of all of this, and
that's
I had no idea.
The one she was just talking
exactly.
About.
I had no idea that it's all these people who have bought personal monitors and are hooking into this network and putting up these statistics. So anyway, I asked our listeners if they are concerned about air quality in their neighborhood and if they're interested in maybe getting any of these monitors. And Studio Visit LA said, I've worn a pollution mask when I ride the streets of LA for over 8 years. Just because you can't see it doesn't mean it's not there. And Amanda Battaglia said, I do keep an eye on air quality. I traveled to Arizona last week and the air quality was awful, which really surprised me. I didn't think of Arizona as having, I mean, it's so flat. Like, why would the air quality be bad there? I looked it up and it turns out that the Phoenix area has among the top five worst air quality
in
the country. And I guess that's true. Yeah. Phoenix itself is in kind of a basin. So only LA, Philadelphia, and Atlanta are worse than Phoenix. And finally, DJ Simonite said, why get one of these monitors? We already know the air is polluted. I guess he agrees with you. A personal monitor is redundant. Just another way for some company to scam you out of your money. So there you go.
Okay. All right. Do we breathe easier now?
I don't know about breathing easier. I do worry about, like, going out and running or, you know, doing that kind of hard exercise. Are you doing more damage than...
What are you
doing
running? just sit still. It's okay. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.